now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Phil, Dean, what will it be today? Now Intercontinental, LA to Australia. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour. It's your Chilpack Hollywood Hour.
Boy, the week has just sped past since I last spoke to you.
I know. Good Lord. At high speed.
It feels like only really 3 days.
Oh, my God. Why do you keep bringing up pre-records like you blow the magic of podcasting?
I'm Phil Lairness. I think people like to know how the audio sausage gets made. And of course, down under, that's Dean Haglund. How are you, Dean?
Yeah, I'm good. Why don't we call our podcast Audio Sausage? I just suddenly realized we made a huge mistake.
Yeah.
That's Audio great. Sausage.
What could be a better title for a show where a couple of middle-aged white guys speak so often about feminist issues?
It's Audio Sausage. Oh, my God.
Okay.
That is funny.
We have a very special episode, and we'll explain not only who our guest is and the connection that the two of you share, but first, we've got a couple of topics to cover, beginning with a very, very fascinating and sad celebrity death.
Celebrity deaths.
A real giant of independent cinema, a man who was called the Master of Light, Dutch cinematographer Robbie Mueller, died at age 78 in Los Angeles this week. He got his start working with Wim Wenders. His first feature was Wim Wenders' Summer in the City in 1970, and that kicked off a very long collaboration with Wenders that included The Scarlet Letter, Alice in the Cities, Kings of the Road, The American Friend, Until the End of the World, and Paris, Texas. He was also a frequent director of photography for Jim Jarmusch, with whom he made Down by Law, Mystery Train, Dead Man, the great black and white Western, Dead Man. Ghost Dog, The Way of the Samurai, and Coffee and Cigarettes.
Oh, my God. That's amazing.
Yes. Dead Man actually scored Mueller the National Society of Film Critics top prize and the New York Critics Circle top prize for best cinematography. He also received those same awards for Lars von Trier's 1996 love story Breaking the Waves. And also shot Lars von Trier's 2000 movie Dancer in the Dark. Other credits include Peter Bogdanovich's Saint Jack, which is one of really my favorite films of the 70s. It features, I think, one of the five greatest performances ever by a lead actor, 1979. He did They All Laugh in 1981. Barbet Schroeder's Barfly, starring Mickey Rourke in 1987.
Yeah.
Michael Winterbottom's 24-Hour Party People, which made Steve Coogan a viable cinematic lead in 2002, and that was Mueller's final film. As I mentioned, he was, so for the last 16 years, he hasn't worked. I mean, 62 was a young age to retire, and I guess he's been sick for a long time. His nickname, the Master of Light, was really interesting because he drew comparisons to another famous Dutchman, but not a Dutch cinematographer or a Dutch photographer. No. The comparison most often made was to painter Vermeer.
Vermeer, of course, because one natural light source coming through a window. If you think about Dancer in the Dark with Bjork working in the factory with Faye Dunaway, you know, anyone else would have lit that so many ways. But it seemed to me, I remember even seeing it then, there was like a natural skylight coming through. And so much of Dancer in the Dark, if you look at that, that was supposed to be that, what did they call that, 85? The cinema verite of the modern era.
Yeah, Dogma 95, yeah.
Dogma 95, yeah. That was supposed to be a representative of Dogma 95 because it was so so using such natural light. And just like Vermeer, who just used the natural light of the window to light all his subjects.
And I think that I'm glad you brought that up because that is the real connection, this idea of natural light and natural light sources, available light, as we would call it sometimes on film shoots, not as in the way we joke about, like, I'm going to use available light on this. In other words, every available light on the truck. No, you use natural light sources, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily naturalistic in terms of its lighting. You are still, a la Vermeer, you are painting with that light.
Yes, you are in full control of where the light comes in and out and all that sort of thing. So it's fascinating to study.
And when you also think of Vermeer, you think of how really in those still frames, right, the story comes out of the character, for crying out loud. Mm-hmm. I mean, we had a whole movie based on the girl in the pearl earring. A movie based on a painting, for crying out loud. So he was nominated for 3 Indie Spirit Awards, and I mentioned some of those critics' prizes. And, of course, he received the International Achievement Award from the American Society of Cinematographers in 2013. That's what a big deal this guy was, that his peers gave them their top prize. But, of course, no Academy Awards, because he didn't make those kind of movies. And there was a quote that Robbie Mueller had at that time in 2013 when he accepted the ASC award. I think he was too sick to attend that ceremony. And so he sent this, and in the note it said, "When I choose to work on a film, the most important thing to me is that it be about human feelings." This is a cinematographer speaking.
Right.
And I think we've both worked with cinematographers who really don't much care what the actor's doing. You know?
Yeah. Did everybody get in focus and in frame?
Yeah.
Let's move on.
It's not my department, or I'm going to impose a style on it because this is what I do. Right? And get me that cinematographer. I want to move the camera like he did in that movie over there, right? And so I really, this is so refreshing. The most important thing to me is that the movie be about human feelings. I try to work with directors who want their films to touch the audience and make people discuss what the film was about long, long after they have left the cinema.
Look at that guy. He's the cinematographer. Why didn't he direct? Sounds like he had the director's...
Well, he didn't need to. He didn't need to. I mean, that's what's great, is that that's why. Look at these filmmakers that he would work with. From, you know, your Bogdanoviches, your Jim Jarmusches, your Wim Wenders. I mean, Lars von Trier. These are people who are as responsible as any other filmmakers for turning cinema into what it was in, let's say, the final quarter of that last century, which was an art form that had supplanted the novel in terms of its importance, not popularly, in terms of its importance in terms of exploring issues and psychology and what it means to be human.
Right. Amazing.
So Robbie Mueller. Now, speaking of movies, we had left a topic on the table last week, and it was about when the reaction by audiences to a movie is dramatically worse than the critical thing. Now, this happens a few times a year, of course, where a film will get great reviews and an audience won't like it as much as critics. Often it's for the films that win big awards and therefore becomes the kind of movie that people feel they should see, but isn't necessarily their, you know, their particular flavor, right?
Right.
But it's still much more rare for audiences to dislike a film more than critics do, because after all, audiences are paying to see something. And when you're paying to see something, you have a vested interest in it being good. You don't want to have wasted your time and your money. So I'm always interested. Now, we mentioned Paul Schrader's Paul Schrader's new movie, First Reformed. It's got 96% positive reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. Excellent. Excellent. Right. But it's a tough movie. It's a tough movie that requires interpretation. It's got heavy, dark themes. So, not surprisingly, the audience reaction is significantly lower. But the audience reaction is still 72% positive. That's still good. That still means the vast majority of audiences. If 72% of critics like it, it is certified fresh on Rotten Tomatoes. For example, we talked about the sci-fi film from Australia, Upgrade, the action film that we talked about last week. That's gotten very good reviews, 85% positive. The audience, 86% positive.
That's good.
Not only does it mean that it's probably a good film, especially if you're a fan of the genre, but it means to me that they marketed it correctly and the right people went to see it.
See, that's a good point. Because I think about, just looking up the biggest gap between critics and user score and user audience score is Warcraft. Now, have you seen Warcraft?
No.
I just watched it the other day.
That got good reviews?
No, it got terrible reviews.
Okay, but we're talking
about... critics hated it.
We're talking about the opposite, though. I get that. What I'm saying is an oddity. Is when critics love something and audiences hate it. Not always, because this is not a, like I said, we gave the example of award winners. There's also the problem with Rotten Tomatoes being a potentially flawed system, because you don't have to prove you've seen the film to rate it. For example, when you see a documentary like Eating Animals, which is about the corporatization of our food supply, when there's a documentary like that, which is out now and it gets 91% positive, not shocking that it's only a 50% user rating, because you know that, I don't know, maybe some of these people rating it are not real people.
Well, yes.
Right?
Because, that's a good point. Yeah, because you're trying to trash the documentary that's trashing your corporate.
Exactly. Because let's face it, if you disagree with that as a knee-jerk reaction, you're not going to go see that documentary. So that's part of the problem here, is you don't have to prove it. But two cases that really make the example that I wanted to discuss. One is, I mentioned it last week, that quote-unquote horror film that really isn't scary or horrifying, Hereditary, Hereditary gets a 90% positive review from critics, 56% from audiences. Why? Because it's not scary. They want it to be scary. They did not get sold what is actually a comedy. That lends itself towards maybe dark comedy a la Rosemary's Baby, but a comedy. It's ultimately for laughs. Critics love it more because, I mean, it goes back to that old era that I used to talk about, where if critics loved a horror movie, I knew it wasn't scary, because for something to be scary, it needs to surprise you. And critics hate being surprised. They want to be smarter than the movies they see. Not a lot smarter, but they want to be a little bit smarter than the movies.
So therefore, any horror movie that gets good critical assessment isn't scary.
No, not necessarily anymore. That isn't true anymore. I'm not saying it. It used to be, I thought. But in recent vintage, we've had some great, great movies that were horror films. But when I see such a discrepancy between what the critics say and between what the audience says, that says to me that movie didn't give them, the audience, what they were promised, and what they were promised was scares.
Right.
And
but now think about comedies then. I mean, the critics loved the new Ghostbusters, the all-female Ghostbusters, and yet the user score on that was just 29, but the critic score was up in the 63. So was this then that the critics have no sense of humor?
But I would ask, I would shudder a little bit about that and ask how many of those user reviews, again, came from people who saw it versus people who rejected it out of hand. Why are you doing it with all chicks?
No,
because we know, absolutely. That had a low user score months before it came out.
Oh. So, because nobody wanted their classic beloved Ghostbusters.
So you have to be careful with the examples on this. I'll be the first to admit that. But one that I don't think anything could be explained by that is this art house film from France, Let the Sun Shine In. It's a 2017 film directed by the legendary Claire Denis, right? She directed the original Chocolat. Her film Beau Travail in 99 is considered a modern cinematic masterpiece, one of the greatest female-directed films in the history of cinema. And she has a kind of a romantic-ish, comedy-ish out with starring Juliette Binoche. It's an adaptation of Roland Barthes' 1977 A Lover's Discourse fragments. I think it's the fourth adaptation of that. And, not surprisingly, very good critical reviews. 85% on Rotten Tomatoes. Now, who would go to see this movie other than art house and foreign language film fans? No one. Other than the intended audience would go to see this. And their reviews... 22%. 85
Ouch.
To 22. Which means they did not get the lighthearted, artsy, romantic comedy they were expecting. And indeed, this movie's uncomfortable to watch. It's kind of it's masking through its lightness of being just how dark and unpleasant a psychological reality these characters live in. And audiences, I was not prepared for that at all. It doesn't make it a bad movie, but it isn't a movie I enjoyed very much, and largely that's not the movie's fault. It's the expectation I brought in based on the marketing.
See, so this now comes to the importance of marketing again, as we come time and time again to point our finger at the marketing team that is behind all of these. Well, not all of them, but, you know, how critical your marketing is to getting this thing not just known, but to set up everybody's expectation correctly. And so many of them don't even think about that. I know I have my friends in marketing, and all they are is like, the poster looks good. We got this kind of wide dispersal. This many platforms are showing it. Here's the metrics. Here's the metrics of our market rollout. Okay, let's go. And then the movie bombs, and they go, well, that's the movie maker's fault. And no one sits and goes, are we setting this up right? Is this the right expectation? I've never heard anybody in marketing ever say that.
I know. Isn't that interesting? I'm going to have more to say about this vis-a-vis our film, The Lady Killers, in weeks to come, because it's interesting timing on this, but you know, we're formulating the marketing strategy. Right. And so it's a fascinating, I hope, for audiences, ongoing topic for us to continue to discuss. Right now we have to shift gears. We're going to welcome a guest. We have not in a while had a guest. We even longer, I feel it has been since we've had a live event of the week. And so we're going to discuss at length a live event that is sci-fi related. It's rock opera related. If I Dean doesn't like to talk about music very often, but boy, he loves opera, and he's been known to love a rock opera or two. And of course, you have something very much in common with the live event, or a connection, a deep connection to the live event we will be discussing. So let's have Garrett Watley set it up, and we'll be joined in just a moment by our guest.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
So, Dean Haglund, do you remember a few years back here in Los Angeles, one of the cool things you got to act in was a one-act production of Ray Bradbury's Kaleidoscope?
Yes, part of the Sci-Fi Theater Festival.
Right.
The short-lived Sci-Fi Theater Festival.
Not short-lived.
Festival.
It was short. Because you were only in it 1 year, it's short-lived.
All right. Wait, they didn't cancel it after I didn't do it?
No. In fact, it went on to much greater success. But the point it was for 3 years. 3 years running, the one-act science fiction theater festival here in Los Angeles, Sci-Fest, ran to great acclaim and great audience satisfaction. And it just, the changing of the equity rules made it not viable anymore logistically.
That's why it was short-lived.
When you have, but it's something lasting 3 years? In Los Angeles,
that's true.
Hollywood moves fast.
You qualify for a lifetime achievement award if you last 3 years here. But I was thinking about you because Kaleidoscope is one of four Ray Bradbury pieces that are being included in a rock opera that is set to debut in Cincinnati, and with us via the magic of podcasting is the composer of that rock opera, Zach Greenberg. Zach, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yeah, thank you.
This is exciting.
So this is exciting.
Is this your first rock opera of sci-fi? How did this tell me all about it?
Yeah, it's my first rock opera, and it's with a company in Cincinnati called Concert Nova. And his name is Ted Nelson, and we had been trying to figure out a project to do together for a while. And it's nice that, cause you always get asked, when did it start? And this project I can actually trace back, cause it started right around when Bowie passed away. And that's what we were talking about.
Spoiler alert.
And art in general. Yeah, exactly.
Wait,
for all
Bowie
those who didn't, for anyone who didn't know, sorry.
Well, bum me out.
We've been keeping that from Dean, Zach, but anyway.
Didn't get that news down. Holy smokes. We still think he's alive down here.
Whatever you do, don't let Dean know who has become president in his absence.
That's right.
Another spoiler, it's not Bowie.
damn it. I voted for him.
But so what about his death? Was his death actually involved in the inspiration behind this?
Well, no, he was the inspiration of the discussion, and we were just talking about character in music and in sound, and how, because it's four movements and each one is a different story from The Illustrated Man, and they each sound totally different. And that kind of pulled from Bowie's life, of just how, for him, it's what I think the most important thing was his character, really, each album really sounds totally different. Each section of his life, and the sound was just supplemental to the character in the story,
right? A Ziggy Stardust, as it were, as a character running the album.
So the name of this this rock opera that you've written is what?
It's The Bradbury Tattoos.
The Bradbury Tattoos. And it's in four movements, and if I understand correctly, each of these movements, each of these pieces, is put on in a different room.
Probably for the next staging. Was, as you guys know how it all goes, that was the original idea. And then as we started getting through for this being the premiere, we decided we needed to cut out that part.
Okay, you know, but
simplify.
I did.
We had to simplify it.
But I did read. So right. I did read about that and understand it correctly, though. And it's an idea that makes a lot of sense, a la kind of Sleep No More and other immersive theater, right? Where an audience would go
room. Audience walk.
Yeah, would go room to room, and because you mentioned about how each of these four stories in Illustrated Man have such a different energy to them. And what I love, and one of the things that like I talk to my actors that I teach is, you know, just a simple exercise, go home and go to different rooms in your house and just feel how naturally your energy shifts completely when you go from one room to another within your own home. And so, you know, to get people up and on their feet and moving and immersing in another space, what a great way to get them to not only think about these things, but to open themselves to another new experience.
And it also opens up a big thing for this because, you know, the story, it's all about this illustrated man, this you know, tattooed man from a Dust Bowl carnival kind of thing. He was tattooed by a witch doctor. So each of his tattoos move. And that's really the connective tissue of the book, you know, because it's really just a collection of short stories. But Bradbury made it all connect with this illustrated man. And he's being, he's on the road with this other hobo sort of character. It leads in really well to the different rooms because you're able to have a guide of sorts who really ties you into the whole thing. And, you know, the audience breaks up and then they can all happen simultaneously. And anyway, so for the next one, which maybe will be in Hollywood.
Okay. You know? Well, I mean, look, don't kid yourself. Dean is going through his emails right now looking for the one where he was offered the chance to reprise the role of the captain of the ship in Kaleidoscope. But
what?
I'm curious, Zach, musically, then does that mean that for each of these movements, you are writing entirely new and different sounding material, or are there themes that weave throughout?
There are themes, but they're not really tonally similar. So there's some bass pattern stuff and some melody that reappears and, you know, some connective tissue, but they appear in very different places in different ways. So like in Kaleidoscope, it's this really abstract spatial thing, you know, the whole piece, and it's immersive and it's almost a reverse round where the audience is in the middle and the instruments are on the outside, and it's this
whole
360, and the vocalists are around the room.
Sounds cool.
And so, sorry, go ahead.
Well, so the music is all entirely live.
And it's all, well, it's live. There are some sample stuff. I also do a lot of field recording and soundscape. So a couple of them have some soundscapes that I built from different sounds I've collected. And this one actually has some different space sort of, you know, atmospheric things for all of the instruments to exist on top of.
Well, that would be another reason, though, with all these live performers where, maybe we'll wait to tackle the challenge of going room to room.
Did they have to drag their instruments room to room as well?
Well, we were going to have them go, the first three go on simultaneously. So so it would have been basically four string quartets for the whole gambit of instruments four times over.
Holy crap. What space did you have that you did not have sound bleeding room to room?
Oh, it's this amazing hall. It's called Memorial Hall in downtown Cincinnati. And it's kind of like being inside a Fabergé egg, just the amount of stonework in there. It's this beautiful old historic venue. There's three floors. So each one was going to be on a different floor to eliminate some sound bleed. And
here are two of the most unusual tidbits about Zach's biography that I have gleaned thus far. He has spent an entire month in a Google chat room, and he's been inside a Fabergé egg. I mean,
that is fascinating. Yeah. So you have three operas going on simultaneously.
Yeah.
And then they repeat four times, I guess, so that everybody can go and actually see or hear the whole opera.
Yeah.
How does that work?
Exactly. And so, as you can see, there's for a world premiere, there it added a lot of layers that, like, rehearsal time, you know, rehearsing yes. for completely different bands, you know, there's so
wow. What is, are they unionized band members?
Okay. All right. But let's move away from what the
from
show
logistics.
Let's move away from what the show isn't at this point, Dean, since it is not right. in four different rooms.
And, oh, right. It's all in one room now.
Right. And yeah. you are not the captain in Kaleidoscope. So let's move towards what it is. And what it is a show that's been funded in part by the National Endowment of the Arts, for crying out loud.
Yeah. Which was obviously amazing. You know,
and
we were applying for it, and as you would guess, you know, I kind of half-heartedly and expecting it to be, you know, the kind of the first application to hopefully get it down the road or something. And then we got it.
Well, yeah, because
we a little
breaking news,
amazing.
Breaking news to me. Apparently we still have a National Endowment for the Arts.
to me too. That's when Concert Nova was applying for it that, you know, I think we were all kind of thinking that, but here it is.
Yeah, it's still an advertiser on PBS. Like, it's got to still exist somehow.
You watch a lot of PBS down there in Sydney, Australia, do you?
I got a weird digital feed from it. Yeah, I do. Yeah.
Dean Haglund having a weird digital feed explains so much about who Dean Haglund is. So, Zach, what's the connection to Cincinnati for you?
Cincinnati, my dad's side of the family is all from there. And I still have family there that I'm really close with. So I grew up living there a little bit. I went to some elementary school there. I moved around a lot, I've told hippie parents. So
cool.
Where were you actually born?
In Durango, Colorado.
Durango, Colorado, which is exactly
of course.
Like what I think of as ground zero for hippie parents, quite frankly.
Yeah, exactly. And that's where I am now with my mom's house for a couple of days.
So if this goes well, this is a show that you're going to be with for a long time.
Yeah. And with, it has huge potential, huge legs. And we've already been talking to some other producing people, some other backers about having it travel. And obviously we need to get through this first one. And as you can imagine, we're right in the thick of all the rehearsals and everything. So the idea is for it to definitely have a future, for this to be the first of many. But as you know, with projects, you can only think so far ahead when you're in the,
but
in
this
the
is,
trenches.
This is such a big, such a big undertaking. And you indeed, as we've discussed, and that I was worried Dean wouldn't let go of, you have even bigger ideas in mind for this. How does someone, you're a young man, envision this and not be daunted by the size of this?
Yeah, I think that part of it was that I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. And
classic.
And I didn't really know what I was getting myself into. Even we'd started rehearsing, and then, you know, I had recorded a couple little, you know, sections of rehearsals to listen back to later to do some edits. And it wasn't really until I was sitting with the recordings that it really started to set in that I had written an opera. You know, because Ted had been, we had been talking about it, and he was like, well, maybe we'll get you, you know, someone else will write some of the sections, you can write it. And I was like, no, I'll do it, you know. And again, I think that was kind of, wasn't exactly aware of how much material that was. And it's a lot. It's a lot of material, as you can imagine.
Yeah. So you're doing four Bradbury stories, including Kaleidoscope. Was Kaleidoscope in Illustrated Man?
Yeah.
Because I only knew it as the one-act play where the spaceship blows up and everybody dies. You know, I could see why you would choose that in an opera.
What yeah, are, so... What are, the, sorry. Yeah, the other ones are The Highway.
I love that it got described as the one where it blows up and everyone dies. There's Dean Haglund, always always avoiding giving away the ending, and that's
oh my god! Like he wouldn't know.
It's 30
it's
minutes.
Definitely it's more of a
30 minutes of actors pretending to be dead on stage. It's terrific.
Yeah, in space with the lights off, space. All floating around.
I would watch that.
Please, I'm sorry, Zach. Go on with your story.
So, one is The Highway, and the premise is this little farm house kind of south of the border. It's just this husband and wife, and they live right on a highway that tourists are constantly blowing by and stopping to take pictures and stuff. And then all of a sudden, every single tourist in the country starts leaving. And you come to find out that the atomic war has started and everyone's fleeing back up north. And so it's this story of this husband and wife that are really unaffected in a lot of ways, but also deeply affected by the whole situation. And then another of one, they're all kind of personal. Day by day, the personal favorite seems to change. But at the moment, one is called Zero Hour, and it's story of children.
The game one, right? Where they have a game, and they get aliens to invade or something?
Yeah, they're all remember playing, reading all that. All the kids are playing Space Invaders sort of thing, and Martians invade Earth. And all the parents are kind of ignoring it. And it's this utopian society in the future where there's a whole force field set up around the planet and aliens can't get in. But they figure out that they can whittle their way in through the children's creativity. And so all of the parents are not paying attention to the kids are playing this game and all talking about these Martians and building these things that no one's really paying attention to until all of a sudden aliens start getting sucked through their imaginations.
Right.
So many words.
Yes. I remember this as reading this as a teenager, and the critical analysis was that this was a warning not to be creative. So I had to put that one down.
Yeah. And then the final one is the last night of the world, I believe is the, sorry, I've been working with working titles.
Right, right.
But yeah, The Last Night of the World, I believe, is the correct full title. And it's everybody on the planet knows that it's the last night on Earth. And no one really knows how. There's kind of this collective consciousness dream going around that everybody's sort of had and no one's talking about. And this is the simplest movement. I just set it to just a classic string quartet, and it's just a husband and wife duet. And it's just how this husband and wife choose to spend their last night together, which is pretty simple. And they just kind of do what they would normally do. So which
they play words with friends till dawn.
Exactly. Well, it's the 50s, so a lot of what they do is drink coffee and ignore their children is something we've noticed. And amongst the creative team has been like, isn't it kind of funny that their kids are in the room next to them and they don't spend any of the time with them at all?
Wow.
Oh, man. If only I had known that was an option earlier, I would have ignored my kids a long time ago. Why does it? Why does it always take a disaster to make us realize what's truly important, especially when it involves getting to ignore our kids? So Zach, have you always been a science fiction fan, and were you did you have an affinity for Ray Bradbury?
Yes, both. I'm a huge sci-fi geek, for lack of better words. My two favorites are Philip K. Dick, who's a classic, obviously, uh-huh. But then Stanislaw Lem, who's kind of the Polish version of him, almost. This book, The Star Diaries, was a huge part of my high school life.
Solaris is still my, right up there with my top sci-fi. Now, you spend some of your time out here in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, I work with a lot of modern dance. I do some ballet too, but I mainly work with Charlotte Catherine and Company, and then Sean Green Shieldwall, and a handful of others out in L.A. But wow. Those are my main two.
Did you ever get the chance to attend Ray Bradbury's theater out here and see any of the stage productions that he would produce?
I have not, but I know that they're amazing, and I plan on attending.
Well,
when time works out.
Yeah, he's not really involved anymore.
Well, yeah,
dead. But what is so fun about this, and again, it's a little bit unusual for us to talk about something, especially from the point of view of music, because Dean has gone on record as saying, you know, I don't like music.
I don't like modern music,
but
I don't blame you, Dean.
But okay, thank you, Zach. That we makes, could have a long talk about why music sucks. Now.
That makes one of us, Zach. But Dean trained in modern dance. So
that's right.
Another connection, mm-hmm. And indeed,
exactly.
And I used to work for Ray Bradbury at UCLA. So, connections on this podcast.
And tell me, how is the modern dance scene going in Los Angeles? Are audiences coming out to see the things you score with the bodies moving around?
Yeah, it's alive. You know, I also spend my time in New York, and it's different. You know,
yes.
It's very different. I live... My apartment in New York is basically across the street from Paul Taylor's studio. By basically, I mean, it is. I look out the window and Taylor's right there.
Is that right? That's hilarious.
And so I'm constantly at BAM and at the Joyce. And the scene in LA is different again.
Yeah.
You know, but it's amazing. And I think that it's more accessible in a lot of ways, and especially more accessible for people, for young choreographers and composers. And I went to Idlewild Arts Academy for high school. I don't know if you guys know.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Idlewild's a big deal.
Yeah, so Charlotte and I went to high school together. And L.A. afforded us a lot of opportunities to create work as we were starting out. That I think New York has, but also it's a little more...
expensive.
Expensive,
yeah, in the word,
yes, and it's because space is a thing, as you know, with dance, mm-hmm. especially when you're involving live instruments. In New York, if you want space, it's expensive because there's not a lot of it,
right. Whereas Los Angeles still has areas that you can find big raw space to run around, you throw some lights in there, and you got yourself a dance show.
Yeah, Deborah Brockes, her company is Brockes Red, and she was the head of Idlewild when we were there, and we're still super mm-hmm. close. And she has her studio in the Brewery District, I think is what it's called.
Yeah,
where Diablo is also there. And so that's where we get to work a lot there. And that whole area is amazing and really...
Yeah, my best friends live there, actually.
Cool.
They have... second floor, main room, main building up front.
Uh-huh.
And they have the art walk every year there too, right?
Yeah, it's super cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. It's the old Coors Brewery, or was it?
I think PBR, maybe? I don't know.
Oh, yeah. And then two brothers bought it, and everybody said, you're nuts, and they just rented it out, and now they're bazillionaires.
Because
it's just filled with artists. And the rent is super cheap there still.
Yeah, it's totally affordable. And again, it's something that
for those of you just joining us, just tuning in, you're listening to Dean Haglund's guided walking tour.
No, I love that space. But this is how we can have modern dance in a large city.
Well, I'm intrigued to dial this back to Zach's music. I'm intrigued about how do you know, when do you know, Zach, that you, because you're a musician, you not only write music, you play bass, you are a musician. So many young musicians I know, the impulse is, I want to go, I want to be alone, I want to make my music, I want to play my music for people. And everything that you've been talking about is this this need to collaborate with other performers in other mediums.
How which kind of gets
Yeah. How does that come about? And when did you know, okay, this is something that really turns me on?
Yeah. It kind of, like we were joking around with Dean earlier, is that, I don't really like a lot of modern music. I listen to things, you know, kind of 70s and before.
Right. Me too. In your face, Phil Learnett, right there.
And so, long story short, I love sound, and I always thought of sound as being a part of something bigger. So I do a lot of multimedia work. I collaborate with creators of different art forms. It has always been where I've enjoyed working more. So whether it's in film scores, you know, a classic one, obviously, of working with a different one, but a lot of modern dance. And really, I have a multimedia art collective that I helped start called the Almost Holden Collective. We used to have a venue over in Santa Monica. And the whole premise was basically, you know, we were all friends, and none of us, some were film kids, some were visual artists, some were musicians, some were dancers, you know, none of us were in the same field. And we were like, well, why should that stop us from making work together, making art and hanging out?
Right. And that's how that started?
And that's how that started. That was all kind of, I went to NYU then after. And so that was kind of.
You know what, that continues to be a reason why much work does get done, because it as you get older and older, and as you pursue very difficult, challenging, you know, careers, it becomes harder and harder to spend time with your friends. So literally, yeah. I'm convinced that a lot of times that's one of the most important motivations behind projects is, you know what, it would just be fun to work with my friends.
Yeah. Right. And this is why staffing on sitcoms, you just staff your friends, because you're going to be working till 4 a.m. writing. You better be with somebody you like.
So someday, and maybe someday soon, Dean, when you put on your one-man improv modern dance sci-fi show, you have the composer. You know.
You have a friend over here.
Exactly. Like that. And you're joking. I do have a one-man sci-fi
modern dance show. You do? Okay.
Well, no, it's a movement. Let's you say okay. Corporate movement.
And Detroit, where you're moving this fall, would be a wonderful place to put it on. Not far from Cincinnati.
That's right.
And yeah.
Yeah, 5 hours. Zach,
have you been to Detroit ever in your moving around this?
I have. Not since I was a little younger. We had family friends who used to go fishing up there. And I haven't been there recently. A lot of friends have been, though. Art friends, especially film friends, have really kind of turned that into a little haven up there. I know it's like this whole blossoming community of this still being Detroit.
I'm about to step into it full time. So I'm going to be there starting the new year, at least. At least I'm there in October. At most, definitely 2019 and on, I'll be living full time in Detroit.
Poor Zach is scribbling out all his notes and rewriting what you're saying. Now, when is he coming? I don't know.
I don't know.
Just
don't know.
We're gonna have to yeah, send Zach a whole new calendar. So, put the kayak price comparison for flights to Detroit away for right now, Zach.
Everything will be for right now.
Before we dial this back to the Bradbury tattoos, which we want to wrap out on.
Yeah.
If I could, Zach, I wanted to ask you about one of the people with whom you studied, because I'm a big fan of this person, and like you, a bass player, Stanley Clark.
Okay.
For people who don't know, Stanley Clark, born right around the mid of last century, and a huge figure in jazz and jazz fusion. When he starts, he's playing with guys like Gil Evans and Dexter Gordon and Art Blakey. So it is, you know, a living history of jazz through the better part of the second half of the 20th century. What was it like studying with someone like him?
Amazing. And we're still close. We're still pretty close, I have to say. He was really, my dad was always a big advocate, you know, as a good dad of getting me cool lessons. And it was, I was about 14 when I started studying with him, probably 13 or 14. And I was in my punk phase and I just played electric bass and I played it really fast. And I went over to Stanley's for the first time, who's in LA. He lives in LA also, LA local. And I'm in like my all black punk stuff. And Stanley's kind of like, what's going on here? You know, he's like, is this the lawn mowing kid or what's going on? So, but then I start playing for him and he pulls out this bass concerto that he had written. And I guess I impressed him with it because then he pulled out one of his many upright basses in a bow and he put it in my hands and he said, this is an actual bass. And this is what you need to start playing. And I was at the time living in Durango, and that's full circle how I ended up at Idlewild. Cause he was like, look, Durango is amazing and you're extremely talented and you will be the best bass player in Durango. But if you want to be one of the best bass players in the world, you need to get out of Durango and go, you know, be with other kids that are going to destroy you. So then we ended up at Idlewild and he's Stanley has been, I mean, obviously personally, just as far as his bass playing, he was always a huge influence and he's really been an amazing mentor and he really focuses on, it's a big thing in the jazz world for these guys. Really. It's a lot of times it's a really heavy thing for them to be able to pass on because jazz, especially, you know, music in general, especially jazz is such an oral tradition and you grow up so much on the bandstand and, you know, and guys like Stanley have this respect for the art and this respect for the guys who passed it on to them when they were young. And they really, he really does what he can to try to pass it along. Cause I think a lot of them, and I believe Stanley included, you know, doesn't feel that any of the music or anything he does really belongs to him. You know, it kind of belongs to the people that came before and the people that will come after.
So you're a young man, but it's never too early to start mentoring. Do you ever find yourself looking at younger students and reaching out to them in the same way?
I've taught some. If I'm somewhere for more than 2 weeks is a long time. And so it's hard to build to be there enough to really build some foundation. So, but as I get a little older and start ending up in one place more, that's definitely a huge goal of mine is to have maybe not be like teaching, you know, at a university or something, but at least have a handful of students, even if it's just one student that really is meaningful. And definitely that's a huge part of where I would like to end up.
Dean Haglund, do you hear all these influences that either, you know, one or either of us or both of us share? I mean, you know, mentoring, Ray Bradbury, punk bands for crying out loud, modern dance, traveling around all over. I mean, it's safe to say, Dean, and I know it sounds weird, but in this science fiction milieu, which we're exploring right now, if you and I, Dean, were to have a son, and that son was musical. That son might turn out to be Zach, and because we are the parents that we are, Dean, we would just ignore him and drink coffee.
Exactly.
On our last day on earth. Yeah.
All right. So true. We are winding down. I hope this was fun for you, Zach. Please let us know everything we need to know about the Bradbury tattoos. How can people learn more? When will it premiere? How long will it be playing? Where can people find out more about it?
Yeah, so it is at Memorial Hall in Cincinnati on July 13th and 22nd. And those right now are just the two show dates. There'll be two shows each day. There's ticket available at concertnova.com and also on the Memorial Hall website. There's a bunch more info on both of those sites and also on my website, zachgreenberg.com. And hopefully there, as those two dates wrap up, we'll be able to put some more dates up either there or somewhere around the country. Hopefully in Hollywood, so you guys can come.
And Zach, you score for movies. We haven't talked about that. We alluded to some of the work you do with live performances, but we have many filmmakers and aspiring filmmakers who listen to us. So people should absolutely check out Zach's website. Again, Zach, what's that website?
ZachGreenberg.com.
Okay.
So easy.
Dean, you got anything else?
No, I'm on the website right now, reading up on the whole thing. That looks really cool. I like the artwork too.
The artwork we didn't touch on was with Stephen Mast, because you know the tattoos are a huge part of it, and he's this amazing tattoo artist and historian. He also carves surfboards and is a
of course. that's a huge industry, surfboard carving.
and all the artwork he did is amazing, and is all up there.
Fantastic. Well, best of luck on the show. Sorry, I'm not going to see it on these two incarnations, but hopefully as it continues on, as it's got legs, as you say, we'll get to see it.
Yeah, that is for sure. And there'll be plenty more in the future, I'm sure.
Excellent.
Dean, when you hit Detroit, hit the ground running and just find a venue where you could move room from room.
Stay. The old Packard factory, they're reinvigorating as a performance space, I understand.
Yeah, literally.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah. Oh, go ahead, Zach. Sorry. Yeah, I think we were going to the same place on this, but go ahead, Zach. Sorry.
I think that there's a lot of space in Detroit.
Yeah, that was the polite way. Such a polite boy, Zach is. All right. Well, this is delightful. We'll sign off, and then we'll see if Zach might have any music he can let us use at the tail end of this. You can find every installment of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour at chillpackhollywood.com, C-H-I-L-L-P-A-K, Hollywood.com, and wherever good podcasts can be found.
That's right. And follow us on Twitter and Instagram. We're at Dean and Phil. Spell out the word and. Hashtag we give great hashtag.
Very good. All right. like us on Facebook, won't you? We're at facebook.com/chillpackhollywood. And write us. Can people write us?
Yes.
Dean?
I think they can at chillpackhollywood@yahoo.com. So easy.
We'd love to hear from you. We like to talk about what you want us to talk about. It's one of the things we mean when we say it's your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour. Indeed, this is how our conversation with Zach came about. Our friend Fred Anderson reached out to us.
Thank him.
And magic ensued.
So thanks, Zach.
All right. Thanks, Zach. Yes. Best of luck.
Thank you for having me.
Guests of your Chill Pack Hollywood Hour stay at the Baldwin Hills Motor Inn.
In a historic building in downtown Los Angeles.
Promotional consideration paid for by Empire State Gas. From farm to pump, we've got great gas.
belated spoiler alert.